Chapter 41. He is coming. On Wednesday, September 4th, Hitler stepped to the rostrum at the Berlin Sportpalast, where some years earlier he had made his first speech as Chancellor of Germany. Now he prepared to speak to a huge audience of female social workers and nurses, ostensibly to honour the opening of the year's war winter relief campaign, Kriegswinterhilfswerk, to raise money to provide food, heat and clothing to impoverished Germans. He used the opportunity, however, to launch a tirade against Britain for its recent air attacks against Germany. "Mr. Churchill," he said, "is demonstrating his new brainchild, the night air raid." Hitler decried such raids as being cowardly, unlike the daylight sorties conducted by the Luftwaffe. He told his audience that thus far he had tempered his reaction to the British raids, in hopes that Churchill would reconsider and halt them. "But Herr Churchill saw in this a sign of weakness," Hitler said. "You will understand that we are now answering, night for night, and when the British Air Force drops 2 or 3 or 4,000 kilograms of bombs, then we will, in one night, drop 150, 230, 300 or 400,000 kilograms." At this, wrote American correspondent William Shirer, a great roar rose from the crowd and forced Hitler to pause. He waited for the clamour to subside, then said, "When they declare that they will increase their attacks on our cities, then we will raise their cities to the ground." He vowed to stop the handiwork of these air pirates, so help us God. The women leapt to their feet, Shirer wrote in his diary, and their breasts heaving screamed their approval. Hitler continued, "The hour will come when one of us will break, and it will not be National Socialist Germany." The crowd erupted in a deafening tumult, crying, "Never! Never!" In England, they're filled with curiosity and keep asking, "Why doesn't he come?" Hitler said, infusing every gesture with irony. "Be calm! Be calm! He's coming! He's coming!" The laughter from the audience verged on the maniacal. Churchill offered a bloody rejoinder. That night an RAF bomb fell on Berlin's lovely main park, the Tiergarten, killing a policeman. At Kahrenhall, in the peaceful German countryside, Hermann Göring and his Luftwaffe commanders mapped out a concise, tersely worded plan of attack for the destruction of London. The initial raid was scheduled to begin at 6 p.m., followed by the main attack at 6:40. The purpose of the first raid was to draw RAF fighters into the air, so that by the time the main wave of bombers arrived, the British defenders would be running out of fuel and ammunition. Three fleets of bombers, guarded by a large screen of fighters, would set out from three locations on the Channel's French coast and proceed on a straight-line course to London. The fighters would accompany the bombers all the way to the city and back. "In view of the fact that the fighters will be operating at the limit of their endurance," the plan said, "it is essential that direct courses be flown and the attack completed in minimum time." The plan called for maximum force, with aircraft flying at staggered altitudes. "The intention is to complete the operation in a single attack." With so many aircraft in the air, it was imperative that the pilots also know how to orchestrate their return. After dropping their bombs, the formations were to turn left and return along a course different from the one they had followed to England, to avoid colliding with bombers still making their approach. "To achieve the necessary maximum effect, it is essential that units fly as highly concentrated forces during approach, attack, and especially on return," the plan said. "The main objective of the operation is to prove that the Luftwaffe can achieve this." The date was set for September 7th, 1940, a Saturday. Göring told Goebbels the war would be over in 3 weeks. Among the bomber groups assigned to take part was a special unit called KGR 100, one of three groups known as Pathfinders. Its crews were specialized in flying along Germany's navigational beams, taking advantage of a technology even more advanced than the Knickerbein system, which was proving problematic. The genius of Knickerbein was its simplicity and the fact that it used familiar technology. Every German bomber pilot knew how to use ordinary Lorentz blind landing equipment when approaching an airfield, and every bomber had the system aboard. To use Knickerbein, Pilots just had to fly higher and follow the central beam for longer distances. But something seemed to have gone amiss. Pilots reported mysterious beam distortions and lost signals, and were growing distrustful of the system. A major raid against Liverpool on the night of August 29th had been severely and mysteriously disrupted, with only about 40% of the dispatched bombers reaching their targets. It seemed likely that British intelligence had discovered the Knickerbein secret. Happily, another technology, this one even more advanced, remained as secret as ever, as best anyone could tell. German scientists had developed another method of beam navigation, called X-Verfahren, or X-System, that was much more precise but also much more complicated. It too relied on the transmission of Lorentz-like dash and dot signals, but instead of just one intersecting beam, it incorporated three, these much narrower, and thought to be harder for RAF listeners to detect. The first beam to cross the bomber's course was merely a warning signal, meant to alert its wireless operator that a second, more crucial, intersection was coming soon. Upon hearing that second signal, a crew member turned on a mechanism that calibrated the plane's exact ground speed. Soon afterward, the bomber crossed a third and final intersecting beam, at which point the crew started a timer that controlled the plane's bomb-release mechanisms so that the plane would disgorge its bombs at exactly the moment necessary to hit the target. The system was effective, but because it demanded highly skilled and trained crews, the Luftwaffe formed a special bomber group, KGR-100, to use it. For the system to work, the aircraft had to fly precisely on course, at a steady speed and at the calibrated altitude, until it reached its target, leaving it vulnerable to attack. This made for some hair-raising moments, but bombers using the system flew at very high altitudes to pick up the beam well beyond the range of searchlights and barrage balloons, and had little risk, at least at night, of being intercepted by RAF fighters. The group's aircraft were painted matte black on every surface to make them all the more difficult to locate in darkness. This also imparted an aura of menace. Trials at a test range on a lake near Frankfurt found that crews could place bombs within 100 yards of a target. As early as December 1939, the group had made 3 test flights to London with no bombs aboard. Over time, the Luftwaffe developed a new tactic to take advantage of KGR-100's special abilities. The group's bombers would take the lead during raids, arriving first to mark targets by dropping a mix of incendiary and high-explosive bombs that ignited immense fires to guide the pilots following behind. The glow was visible even through clouds. The group's zone of operations was expanded to include London. Chapter 42. Ominous Doings. On Friday evening, September 6th, Churchill left 10 Downing for Chequers, where, after his usual nap, he had dinner with Pug Ismay and his 2 top generals, John Dill, chief of the Imperial General Staff, and Alan Brooke, commander-in-chief of Home Forces. Dinner began at 9. The talk centred on the potential for invasion, and there was much to discuss. Intercepted signals and reconnaissance photos suggested that concrete preparations for an invasion had begun and were rapidly progressing. That weekend, British intelligence counted 270 barges at the Belgian port city of Ostend, where, just a week earlier, there had been only 18. 100 barges arrived at Flushing, Vlissingen, on Holland's North Sea coast. Reconnaissance aircraft spotted many more vessels converging on Channel ports. Britain's Joint Intelligence Committee assessed that the coming days, in particular September 8th through 10th, would present a combination of moon and tide that would be especially conducive to an amphibious landing. On top of this came reports of increased bombing activity. That day alone, 300 long-range bombers, accompanied by 400 fighters, attacked targets in Kent and the Thames estuary. The conversation became animated. "PM warmed up and was most entertaining for rest of evening," Brooke wrote in his diary. "First of all, he placed himself in the position of Hitler and attacked these isles while I defended them. He then revised the whole of the air raid warning system and gave us his proposals to criticize. Finally, at 1:45 a.m., we got off to bed. In his diary the next day, Brooke wrote, "All reports look like invasion getting nearer." For him, as the general in charge of defending Britain from attack, the tension was great. "I do not think I can remember any time in the whole of my career when my responsibilities weighed heavier on me than they did during those days of the impending invasion," he wrote later. The survival of Britain would rest on his preparations and his ability to direct his forces, despite what he knew to be their shortcomings in training and armament. "All this," he wrote, "made the prospect of the impending conflict a burden that was almost unbearable at times." Compounding this was the fact that he felt he could not reveal his inner concerns. Like Churchill, he understood the power and importance of outward appearance. He wrote, "There was not a soul to whom one could disclose one's inward anxieties without risking the calamitous effects of lack of confidence, demoralization, doubts, and all those insidious workings which undermined the power of resistance." On that Saturday, September 7th, the question before Brooke and the chiefs of staff was whether to issue the official alert, codenamed Cromwell, that would indicate that invasion was imminent and require Brooke to mobilize his forces. Chapter 43. Gap Blancnay. On Saturday morning, Göring and two senior Luftwaffe officers made their way along the French coast in a motorcade, consisting of three large Mercedes-Benzes led by soldiers on motorcycles. His special train had brought him from his temporary headquarters at The Hague to Calais, so that he could travel in comfort and examine new troves of art along the way, accompanied always by a detachment of 20 plainclothes members of Heinrich Himmler's Sicherheitsdienst, the State Security Service, or SD. If he saw something he liked, he could have it packed aboard immediately. Göring exhibited an all-embracing acquisitiveness, according to a later report by U.S. investigators. There were no limits to his desires as far as the collection was concerned. His long leather coat made him look immense. Underneath, he wore his medals and his favorite white uniform. The cars climbed to the top of Cap Blancnay, one of the highest points on the French coast, and, in more peaceful times, a popular picnic ground. Here the officers set up tables and chairs and laid out a meal of sandwiches and champagne. The chairs were collapsible, and care was taken to ensure that the one given to Göring was as sturdy as possible. The officers were here to watch the start of the Luftwaffe's attack on London, set to begin that afternoon. At about 2 o'clock continental time, Göring and the others heard the first sounds of the bombers, a low hum rising to the north and south. Officers stood on their toes to scan the horizons. Göring raised his binoculars. An officer called out and pointed down the coast. Soon the sky was filled with bombers and their fighter escorts, and high above them, barely visible, additional waves of single-engine Messerschmitt 109s, positioned to take on the British fighters that, without doubt, would rise to meet the assault. German ace Gallant and his squadron were assigned to sweep the English coastline for RAF interceptors. So confident was Göring that the day would bring the Luftwaffe a stunning success, he announced to a group of radio reporters present on the cliff that he had taken personal command of the attack. This was the kind of moment Göring adored, the grand coup with him the center of attention. "This moment is a historic one," he told the correspondents. "As a result of the provocative British attacks on Berlin on recent nights, the Führer has decided to order a mighty blow to be struck in revenge against the capital of the British Empire. I personally have assumed the leadership of this attack, and today I have heard above me the roaring of the victorious German squadrons." The mood on the clifftop was one of elation. Barely able to restrain his glee, Göring grasped the shoulder of an officer next to him and, beaming, shook it hard, as if acting in a film for Goebbels's Ministry of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. Part 4. Blood and Dust. September to December. Chapter 44. On a Quiet Blue Day. The day was warm and still, the sky blue above a rising haze. Temperatures by afternoon were in the 90s. Odd for London. People thronged Hyde Park and lounged on chairs set out beside the Serpentine. Shoppers jammed the stores of Oxford Street and Piccadilly. The giant barrage balloons overhead cast lumbering shadows on the streets below. After the August air raid, when bombs first fell on London proper, the city had retreated back into a dream of invulnerability, punctuated now and then by false alerts, whose once terrifying novelty was muted by the failure of bombers to appear. The late summer heat imparted an air of languid complacency. In the city's West End, theatres hosted 24 productions, among them the play Rebecca, adapted for the stage by Daphne du Maurier from her novel of the same name. Alfred Hitchcock's movie version, starring Laurence Olivier and Joan Fontaine, was also playing in London, as were the films The Thin Man and the long-running Gaslight. It was a fine day to spend in the cool green of the countryside. Churchill was at Chequers. Lord Beaverbrook departed for his country home, Charkley Court, just after lunch, though he would later try to deny it. John Colville had left London the preceding Thursday to begin a 10-day vacation at his aunt's Yorkshire estate with his mother and brother, shooting partridges, playing tennis, and sampling bottles from his uncle's collection of ancient port in vintages dating to 1863. Mary Churchill was still at Breckles Hall, with her friend and cousin Judy, continuing her reluctant role as country mouse and honouring their commitment to memorise one Shakespeare sonnet every day. That Saturday she chose Sonnet 116, in which love is the ever-fixed mark, and recited it to her diary. Then she went swimming. It was so lovely. Joie de vivre overcame vanity. Throwing caution to the winds, she bathed without a cap. In Berlin that Saturday morning, Joseph Goebbels prepared his lieutenants for what would occur by day's end. The coming destruction of London, he said, would probably represent the greatest human catastrophe in history. He hoped to blunt the inevitable world outcry by casting the assault as a deserved response to Britain's bombing of German civilians. But thus far, British raids over Germany, including those of the night before, had not produced the levels of death and destruction that would justify such a massive reprisal. He understood, however, that the Luftwaffe's impending attack on London was necessary, and would likely hasten the end of the war. That the English raids had been so puny was an unfortunate thing, but he would manage. He hoped Churchill would produce a worthy raid as soon as possible. Every day offered a new challenge, tempered now and then by more pleasant distractions. At one meeting that week, Goebbels heard a report from Hans Hinkel, head of the ministry's Department for Special Cultural Tasks, who'd provided a further update on the status of Jews in Germany and Austria. In Vienna, there are 47,000 Jews left out of 180,000, two-thirds of them women and about 300 men between 20 and 35, Hinkel reported, according to minutes of the meeting. In spite of the war, it has been possible to transport a total of 17,000 Jews to the southeast. Berlin still numbers 71,800 Jews. In future, about 500 Jews are to be sent to the southeast each month. Plans were in place, Hinkel reported, to remove 60,000 Jews from Berlin in the first 4 months after the end of the war, when transportation would again become available. The remaining 12,000 will likewise have disappeared within a further 4 weeks. This pleased Goebbels, though he recognized that Germany's overt anti-Semitism, long evident to the world, itself posed a significant propaganda problem. As to this, he was philosophical. "Since we are being opposed and calumniated throughout the world as enemies of the Jews," he said, "why should we derive only the disadvantages and not also the advantages? That is, the elimination of the Jews from the theatre, the cinema, public life and administration. If we are then still attacked as enemies of the Jews, we shall at least be able to say, with a clear conscience, it was worth it. We have benefited from it." The Luftwaffe came at tea time. The bombers arrived in three waves, the first composed of nearly 1,000 aircraft, 348 bombers and 617 fighters. 8 specially equipped Heinkel bombers of the KGR-100 Pathfinder group led the way, carrying a combination of standard high-explosive bombs, incendiary oil bombs, Flammenbomben, and bombs with time-delayed fuses meant to keep firefighting crews at bay. Despite clear weather and daylight, they used the X system of beams to navigate. In London, the first siren sounded at 4:43 p.m. Writer Virginia Coles and a friend, Anne, were staying at the home of a British press baron, Esmond Harmsworth, in the village of Merriworth, about 30 miles southeast of central London. They were having tea on the lawn, enjoying the warmth and sun, when a low thrum rose from the southeast. "At first we couldn't see anything," Coles wrote, "but soon the noise had grown into a deep, full roar, like the faraway thunder of a giant waterfall." She and her friend counted more than 150 planes, the bombers flying in formation, with fighters surrounding them in a protective shield. "We lay in the grass, our eyes strained towards the sky. We made out a batch of tiny white specks, like clouds of insects moving northwest in the direction of the capital." She was struck by the fact that they proceeded without interference by the RAF, and guessed that somehow the German planes had broken through England's defences. "Poor London," her friend said. Coles was correct in observing that the German planes met little resistance, but not about the reason. The RAF, alerted by radar that a huge force of bombers was crossing the channel, had dispersed its fighter squadrons to take up defensive positions over key airfields, in the assumption that these would yet again be the principal targets. Likewise, anti-aircraft guns had been withdrawn from London to protect the airfields and other strategic targets. Only 92 guns were positioned to protect central London. As soon as the RAF realized that the city was in fact the target, its fighters began converging on the German raiders. One RAF pilot, upon spotting the attackers, was shocked by what he saw. "I'd never seen so many aircraft," he wrote. "It was a hazy sort of day to about 16,000 feet. As we broke through the haze, you could hardly believe it. As far as you could see, there was nothing but German aircraft coming in, wave after wave." The perspective from the ground was equally stunning. One young man, Colin Perry, 18, was on his bicycle when the first wave passed overhead. "It was the most amazing, impressive, riveting sight," he wrote later. "Directly above me were literally hundreds of planes, Germans. The sky was full of them." "The fighters stuck close," he recalled, "like bees around their queen." In the Plumstead district of southeast London, architecture student Jack Graham Wright and his family had settled in their parlour for tea. His mother brought it out on a tray edged with silver, along with cups, saucers, a small jug containing milk, and a teapot under a cosy meant to help the beverage retain heat. The sirens sounded. At first the family felt little concern, but when Wright and his mother looked out the door, they saw the sky full of planes. His mother noted the descent of little, bright things, and realized these were bombs. The two ran for cover under a stairway. "We all became conscious of a growing crescendo of noise, drowning the growl of the planes, and then a series of enormous thuds growing nearer," Wright recalled. "The house shuddered. Its floorboards heaved. Shock waves transmitted from the ground rose upward through their bodies." Wright steadied himself against the door jamb. Then came a surge of noise and energy more powerful than anything before it. The air of the parlour condensed and became opaque, as if turned instantaneously to a red-brown fog, he wrote. The heavy brick party wall that separated his house from the next seemed to flex, and his door jamb shimmied. Slates torn from the roof crashed through the glass of the family's conservatory. "I could hear doors and windows crashing all over the place," he wrote. The heaving stopped. The wall still stood. The brown fog had gone, but everything was covered with a heavy brown dust, which lay so thickly on the floor that it concealed the carpet. A detail became lodged in his memory. The little china milk jug was lying on its side, and the spilt milk lay in a rivulet, dripping over the edge of the table to a white pool in that thick layer of dust below. It was this dust that many Londoners remembered as being one of the most striking phenomena of this attack, and of others that followed. As buildings erupted, thunderheads of pulverized brick, stone, plaster, and mortar billowed from eaves and attics, roofs and chimneys, hearths and furnaces. Dust from the age of Cromwell, Dickens, and Victoria. Bombs often detonated only upon reaching the ground underneath a house. adding soil and rock to the squalls of dust coursing down streets and permeating the air with the rich sepulchral scent of raw earth. The dust burst outward rapidly at first, like smoke from a cannon, then slowed and dissipated, sifting and settling, covering sidewalks, streets, windshields, double-decker buses, phone booths, bodies. Survivors exiting ruins were coated head to toe as if with grey flour. Harold Nicholson, in his diary, described seeing people engulfed in a thick fog, which settled down on everything, plastering their hair and eyebrows with thick dust. It complicated the care of wounds, as one physician, a Dr. Morton, quickly discovered that Saturday night. What struck one was the tremendous amount of dirt and dust, the dirt and dust of ages blown up in every incident, she wrote. Her training in keeping the wounded free of infection proved useless. Their heads were full of grit and dust. Their skin was ingrained with dust, and it was completely impossible to do anything much about antisepsis at all. Particularly jarring was the sight of blood against this grey background, as writer Graham Greene observed one night after watching soldiers emerge from a bombed building. The purgatorial throng of men and women in dusty, torn pyjamas with little blood splashes standing in doorways. At 5:20 p.m. on Saturday, Pug Ismay and the chiefs of staff met and debated the meaning of the raid. At 6:10 p.m. the all-clear sounded, but at 8 o'clock British radar identified a second wave of German aircraft assembling over France, consisting of 318 bombers. At 8:07 p.m. the chiefs of staff agreed that the time had come to issue the Cromwell alert, notifying home forces that invasion was imminent. Some local commanders went so far as to order the ringing of church bells, the signal that parachutists had been spotted in mid-descent, even though they personally had not seen anything of the kind. By 8:30 that night, bombs were falling in London's Battersea district, but the city's anti-aircraft guns remained strangely silent, not firing until half an hour later, and then only at sporadic intervals. As night fell, RAF fighters returned to base and stayed there, made helpless by the dark. Bombs fell throughout the night. Anyone venturing outside saw the sky glowing red. Fire crews fought immense blazes but made little headway, thereby ensuring that German pilots would have no trouble finding the city. German radio rejoiced. "Thick clouds of smoke spread over the roofs of the greatest city in the world," an announcer said, noting that pilots could feel the shockwaves of detonations even in their planes. When dropping their biggest bombs, the Satan weapons, crews were instructed to stay above 2,000 meters, 6,500 feet, lest they, too, be blown from the sky. "The heart of the British Empire is delivered up to the attack of the German Air Force," the announcer said. One German airman, in a report that bore a whiff of propaganda, wrote, "A blazing girdle of fire stretched round the city of millions. In a few minutes we reached the point where we had to drop our bombs. And where are Albion's proud fighters to be found?" For Londoners, it was a night of first experiences and sensations. The smell of cordite after a detonation, the sound of glass being swept into piles. London resident Phyllis Warner, a teacher in her 30s who kept a detailed journal of life during the war, heard the sound of a bomb falling for the first time. An appalling shriek, like a train whistle growing nearer and nearer, and then a sickening crash reverberating through the earth. As if it would do any good, she put her pillow over her head. Writer Coles recalled the deep roar of falling masonry like the thunder of breakers against the shore. "The worst sound," she said, "was the low droning noise made by the masses of aircraft, which reminded her of a dentist's drill." Another writer present in London that night, John Strachey, recalled the olfactory impact of an explosion, describing it as an acute irritation of the nasal passages from the powdered rubble of dissolved homes, followed by the mean little stink of leaking gas. It was also a night for putting things in context. One woman, Joan Wyndham, later to become a writer and memoirist, retreated to an air raid shelter in London's Kensington neighbourhood where, around midnight, she decided the time had come to cease being a virgin and to employ her boyfriend, Rupert, in the venture. "The bombs are lovely," she wrote. "I think it is all thrilling. Nevertheless, as the opposite of death is life, I think I shall get seduced by Rupert tomorrow." She possessed a condom, a French thingamy, but planned to go with a friend to a pharmacy for a popular spermicide called Valpar, in case the condom failed. The all clear went at 5 a.m., she wrote. All clear for my lovely Rupert, I thought. The next afternoon she followed through on her decision, but the experience fell well short of what she had hoped for. Rupert slipped off his clothes, and I suddenly realized he looked terribly funny in the nude and began laughing helplessly. "What's the matter? You don't like my cock?" he asked, according to a later recollection. "It's all right. Just a bit lopsided." "Most people's are," Rupert said. "Never mind. Take your clothes off." Later, she reflected, "Well, that's done, and I'm glad it's over. If that's really all there is to it, I'd rather have a good smoke or go to the pictures." Dawn on Sunday, September 8th, brought the jarring juxtaposition of clear summer skies and a black wall of smoke in the East End. Residents of Mornington Crescent in Camden Town awoke to find a double-decker bus protruding from the second-story window of a house. Overhead, and as far as one could see, hundreds of barrage balloons, drifting with untroubled ease, turned a comely pink in the rising light. At 10 Downing Street, the private secretary on duty, John Martin, walked outside after spending the night in the building's underground shelter, surprised to find London still there. The night's raids killed over 400 people and caused severe injuries to 1,600 more. For many residents, the night brought another first, the sight of a corpse. When 18-year-old Len Jones ventured into the rubble behind his family's home, he spotted two heads protruding from the wreckage. I recognized one head in particular. It was a Chinese man, Mr. Say. He had one eye closed, and then I began to realize that he was dead. Here, in what hours earlier had been a peaceful London neighborhood. When I saw the dead Chinese, I just convulsed and couldn't get my breath. I was shaking completely. Then I thought, well, I must be dead, as they were, so I struck a match and tried to burn my finger. I kept doing this with a match to see if I was still alive. I could see, but I thought, I cannot be alive. This is the end of the world. The Luftwaffe lost 40 aircraft, the RAF 28, with another 16 fighters badly damaged. To German ace Adolf Galland, this was a success. The day, he said, passed off with ridiculously few losses. His commander, Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, judged the raid to be a major victory, though he recalled with displeasure how Göring, on the cliff at Cap Blanc-Ney, let himself be carried away in a superfluous, bombastic broadcast to the German people, an exhibition distasteful to me both as a man and as a soldier. As the sun rose, Churchill and his entourage, his detective, typist, secretary, soldiers, perhaps Nelson the Cat, raced in from Chequers, Churchill intent on touring the damaged parts of the city and, most importantly, doing so as visibly as possible. Beaverbrook, too, sped back to the city. He persuaded his secretary, David Farrer, working on a book about the Ministry of Aircraft Production, to depict him as having been in the city throughout the raid. Farrer resisted at first. He tried to make Beaverbrook relent by reminding him that many of his own staff had heard him announce his departure for his country home right after lunch on the Saturday of the raid. But Beaverbrook insisted. In a later memoir, Farrer wrote, "It was, I think, inconceivable to him in retrospect that he, the Minister of Aircraft Production, should not have been witness to this cataclysmic moment in air warfare. So he was there, and that was all there was to it." Chapter 45. Unpredictable Magic. Fire still burned and crews were still digging bodies from wrecked buildings when Churchill arrived in the East End, accompanied, as always, by Inspector Thompson, alert to the risks that such a visit posed. Pug Ismay came too, his kind canine face worn by lack of sleep and by grief for the stunned souls the procession encountered along the way. "The destruction was much more devastating than I had imagined it would be," Ismay wrote. "Fires were still raging all over the place. Some of the larger buildings were mere skeletons, and many of the smaller houses had been reduced to piles of rubble." He was struck in particular by the sight of paper Union Jacks planted in mounds of shattered lumber and brick. "These," he wrote, "brought a lump to one's throat." Churchill understood the power of symbolic acts. He stopped at an air raid shelter where a bomb had killed 40 people and a large crowd was gathering. For a moment, Ismay feared that the onlookers might resent Churchill's arrival, out of indignation at the government's failure to protect the city. But these East Enders seemed delighted. Ismay heard someone shout, "Good old Winnie, we thought you'd come and see us. We can take it. Give it 'em back." Colin Perry, who had witnessed the raid from his bicycle, saw Churchill and wrote in his diary, "He looked invincible, which he is. Tough, bulldogged, piercing." Tough, yes, but at times weeping openly, overcome by the devastation and the resilience of the crowd. In one hand he held a large white handkerchief with which he mopped his eyes. In his other he grasped the handle of his walking stick. "You see," an elderly woman called out, "he really cares. He's crying." When he came to a group of dispirited people looking over what remained of their homes, one woman shouted, "When are we going to bomb Berlin, Winnie?" Churchill whirled, shook his fist and walking stick and snarled, "You leave that to me." At this, the mood of the crowd abruptly changed, as witnessed by a government employee named Samuel Battersby. "Morale rose immediately," he wrote. "Everyone was satisfied and reassured." It was the perfect rejoinder for the moment, he decided. What could a prime minister at that time and in such desperate conditions say that was not pathetically inadequate or even downright dangerous? To Battersby, it typified the uniquely unpredictable magic that was Churchill. His ability to transform the despondent misery of disaster into a grimly certain stepping stone to ultimate victory. Churchill and Ismay continued touring the East End well into the evening, causing the dock officials there and Inspector Thompson to grow anxious. After nightfall, the fires would serve as a beacon for what surely would be another attack. The officials told Churchill he must leave the area immediately. But, Ismay wrote, he was in one of his most obstinate moods and insisted that he wanted to see everything. The evening darkened, and the bombers did indeed return. Churchill and Ismay got into their car. As the driver struggled to negotiate blocked and obstructed streets, a cluster of incendiaries landed just ahead, sparking and hissing as if someone had upended a basket of snakes. Churchill, feigning innocence, Ismay believed, asked what the fallen objects were. Ismay told him, and aware that the Luftwaffe used incendiaries to light targets for bombers soon to follow, added that it meant their car was in the middle of the bullseye. The fires already burning would have achieved the same end, however. The Luftwaffe had timed the first raid on Saturday afternoon to give its bomber pilots plenty of daylight to find London by dead reckoning, without the help of navigation beams. The fires they ignited burned throughout the night, serving as visual guides for each successive wave of bombers. Even so, most bombs missed their targets and fell in random patterns throughout the city, prompting American Air Force observer Carl Spatz to write in his diary, "Apparently indiscriminate bombing of London has started." Churchill and Ismay made it back to 10 Downing Street late that night, to find its central hall crowded with staff members and ministers who had grown anxious about Churchill's failure to return before nightfall. Churchill walked past them without a word. The group then pilloried Ismay for exposing the Prime Minister to such danger, to which Ismay replied that anybody who imagined that he could control the Prime Minister on jaunts of this kind was welcome to try his hand on the next occasion. Ismay, in recounting this, noted that the actual language he deployed was much rougher. Concerned that invasion hysteria could confuse things, General Brooke, commander of Home Forces, had on Sunday morning issued an instruction to his commanders that they could order the ringing of church bells only if they themselves actually saw 25 or more parachutists descending, and not because they heard bells ringing elsewhere or because of second-hand reports. The Cromwell alert remained in effect. Concern about invasion intensified. Beaverbrook saw grave warning in the September 7th attack. Upon his return to London, he convened an emergency meeting of his top men, his council, and ordered a tectonic change in the structure of the nation's aircraft industry. Henceforth, large centralized manufacturing centers would be broken up and dispersed to nodes spread throughout the country. A Spitfire plant in Birmingham was divided into 23 buildings in 8 towns. A large Vickers plant that employed 10,000 workers was dispersed into 42 locations, none with more than 500 employees. In a move certain to ignite new bureaucratic strife, Beaverbrook commandeered for himself the authority to requisition manufacturing space at will, no matter its location, provided it was not currently occupied or designated for some crucial war-related function. Beaverbrook also grew concerned about how his newly built aircraft was stored before being transferred to combat squadrons. Up until this point, new aircraft had been housed in large storage buildings, typically at RAF airfields. But now Beaverbrook ordered that these aircraft be scattered throughout the countryside, tucked into garages and barns, to prevent the catastrophic losses that even a single lucky pilot could produce. He had been concerned about such an event since July, when he'd visited a storage depot at Bryce Norton, west of Oxford, and found a large number of aircraft packed closely together, dangerously exposed to enemy attack, as he put it in a note to Churchill. 6 weeks later, his concerns had proved justified, when a raid against the base carried out by just two German aircraft destroyed dozens of planes. The new shelters became known as Robin's Nests. Beaverbrook's dispersion program raised a surge of bureaucratic outrage. He seized buildings that other ministries had earmarked for their own use. "It was high-handed. It was the height of piracy," wrote his secretary David Farrer. But to Beaverbrook, the logic of dispersion was overpowering, no matter the degree of opposition. "It secured him premises for the duration," Farrer wrote, "and enemies for life." It also slowed the output of new aircraft, although this seemed a small cost relative to the assurance that no single raid could cause lasting damage to future production. On Sunday, Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, summoned Albrecht Haushofer for a meeting at the town of Bad Godesberg on the Rhine. Unlike Hess's previous 9-hour summit with Albrecht's father, this meeting lasted a meager 2 hours. "I had the opportunity to speak in all frankness," Albrecht wrote later in a memorandum on the conversation. The two discussed how to communicate to influential officials in England that Hitler really was interested in a peace arrangement. According to Hess, Hitler did not want to destroy the British Empire. Hess asked, "Was there not somebody in England who was ready for peace?" Secure in his friendship with the deputy, Albrecht felt free to speak with a bluntness that might have gotten another man shipped to a concentration camp. The English, he said, would need assurance that Hitler would honour a peace agreement, because practically all Englishmen who mattered regarded a treaty signed by the Führer as a worthless scrap of paper. This perplexed Hess. Albrecht gave him examples and then asked the deputy, "What guarantee did England have that a new treaty would not be broken again at once if it suited us? It must be realized that even in the Anglo-Saxon world, the Führer was regarded as Satan's representative on earth and had to be fought." At length, the conversation turned to the potential use of an intermediary and a meeting in a neutral country. Albrecht suggested his friend the Duke of Hamilton, who has access at all times to all important persons in London, even to Churchill and the King. Whether Albrecht knew it or not, the Duke was now also an RAF sector commander. 4 days later, a letter was on its way to him via an oblique route devised by Hess and Albrecht. The letter suggested, in veiled prose, that the Duke and Albrecht meet on neutral ground, in Lisbon. Albrecht signed the letter with the initial A, in the expectation that the Duke would understand who had sent it. The Duke did not reply. As the silence from England grew long, Hess realized that a more direct approach to him would be necessary. He believed, too, that a mysterious hand was now guiding him. As he wrote later to his son, Wulf, nicknamed Buzz, "Buzz, take notice. There are higher, more fateful powers which I should point out to you. Let us call them divine powers, which intervene at least when it is time for great events." In an ill-timed manoeuvre, Mary Churchill, in the midst of her summer idyll at Breckles Hall, chose that Sunday, September 8th, the day after the immense raid on London, to renew her plea to her parents that she be allowed to return to the city. "I think of you all so often," she wrote in a letter to Clementine, "and I hate to be separated from you and Papa in these dark days. Please, oh, please, Mummy darling, let me come back." She hungered to start working for the Women's Voluntary Services, the WVS, and already had a posting assigned to her in London, arranged by her mother earlier that summer. but she was not scheduled to begin the job until after her Breckles holiday. I would so like to be with you and take my share, and also I do want to begin my work, Mary wrote. She urged Clementine to please not make kitten into evacuee kit. The bombers returned to London that night and again the next day, Monday, September 9th. A bomb struck right over Virginia Woolf's house in Bloomsbury, which served as the headquarters of her Hogarth press. A second bomb also struck the house, but did not immediately explode. It detonated a week later, completing the destruction of her home. Bombs landed in London's West End for the first time. One struck the grounds of Buckingham Palace, but it did not explode until 1:25 the next morning, propelling shattered glass throughout the royal apartments. The King and Queen, however, were not present. They spent each night at Windsor Castle, 20 miles due west of the palace, and commuted to London each morning. With London now under attack, Mary's parents, unswayed by her latest plea, decided to have her spend the winter at Chequers, where she could work full-time for the Women's Voluntary Service in the nearby village of Aylesbury, instead of London. Clementine apparently arranged the change in locale without first consulting Mary. "The ordering of my life must have been settled over the telephone," Mary wrote. On Wednesday, September 11th, the eve of Mary's departure for Chequers, her cousin Judy and Judy's mother Venetia threw a combined birthday and going-away party for her and invited a number of RAF airmen. The party continued well past midnight. In her diary, Mary called it the best one I've been to for ages, and described an encounter with a young pilot named Ian Prosser. "He gave me such a sweet, romantic kiss as he left. Starlight and moonlight, my real romantic atmosphere." That night her father gave a radio address from the underground cabinet war rooms, using the BBC special link to the fortified chamber. The complex was a 5-minute walk from 10 Downing through the heart of Whitehall. The subject of his broadcast was invasion, which seemed ever more imminent. As always, he proffered a mix of optimism and unglazed realism. "We cannot tell," he said, "when they will come. We cannot be sure that in fact they will try at all. But no one should blind himself to the fact that a heavy, full-scale invasion of this island is being prepared, with all the usual German thoroughness and method, and that it may be launched now, upon England, upon Scotland, or upon Ireland, or upon all three. If Hitler did plan to invade," Churchill warned, "he would have to do so soon, before the weather worsened, and before attacks by the RAF on Germany's assembled invasion fleet grew too costly. Therefore, we must regard the next week or so as a very important period in our history. It ranks with the days when the Spanish Armada was approaching the Channel, or when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army at Boulogne. But now," he warned, "the outcome was of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past." Lest his remarks send people cowering en masse, Churchill offered grounds for hope and heroism. The RAF, he said, was more potent than ever, and the Home Guard now numbered 1.5 million men. He called Hitler's bombing of London an attempt to try to break our famous island race by a process of indiscriminate slaughter and destruction. But the attempt by this wicked man had backfired, Churchill said. "What he has done is to kindle a fire in British hearts, here and all over the world, which will glow long after all traces of the conflagration he has caused in London have been removed." The speech was a gloomy one, but it took place on a night when Londoners otherwise felt suddenly heartened, even though German bombers again arrived in force. This new surge in morale had nothing to do with Churchill's speech, and everything to do with his gift for understanding how simple gestures could generate huge effects. What had infuriated Londoners was that during these night raids, the Luftwaffe seemed free to come and go as it wished, without interference from the night-blind RAF, and the city's strangely quiescent anti-aircraft guns. Gun crews were under orders to conserve ammunition and fire only when aircraft were sighted overhead and, as a consequence, did little firing at all. On Churchill's orders, more guns were brought to the city, boosting the total to nearly 200 from 92. More importantly, Churchill now directed their crews to fire with abandon, despite his knowing full well that guns only rarely brought down aircraft. The orders took effect that Wednesday night, September 11th. The impact on civic morale was striking and immediate. Crews blasted away. One official described it as largely wild and uncontrolled shooting. Searchlights swept the sky. Shells burst over Trafalgar Square and Westminster like fireworks, sending a steady rain of shrapnel onto the streets below, much to the delight of London's residents. The guns raised a momentous sound that sent a chattering, smashing, blinding thrill through the London heart, wrote novelist William Sansom. Churchill himself loved the sound of the guns. Instead of seeking shelter, he would race to the nearest gun emplacement and watch. The new cacophony had an immense effect on people's morale, wrote Private Secretary John Martin. Tails are up, and after the fifth sleepless night, everyone looks quite different this morning, cheerful and confident. It was a curious bit of mass psychology, the relief of hitting back. The next day's home intelligence reports confirmed the effect. The dominating topic of conversation today is the anti-aircraft barrage of last night. This greatly stimulated morale. In public shelters, people cheered, and conversation shows that the noise brought a shock of positive pleasure. Even better, on that Wednesday when Churchill spoke and the guns raged, news arrived that the RAF had hit Berlin in force the night before. The severest bombing yet, wrote William Shirer in his diary. For the first time, the RAF dropped large numbers of incendiaries on the city, Shirer noted. Half a dozen landed in the garden of Dr. Joseph Goebbels. Chapter 46. Sleep. In London, as the raids continued, the mundane challenges of daily life became wearing, like the endless dripping of rainwater through roofs perforated by shrapnel. A shortage of glass meant windows had to be patched with wood, cardboard, or canvas. Churchill believed that with winter approaching, part of Luftwaffe Chief Göring's plan was to smash as much glass as possible. Electricity and gas outages were regular occurrences. Commuting to work became a long and tedious process, with a one-hour journey potentially expanding to 4 hours or more. One of the worst effects was lack of sleep. Sirens and bombs and anxiety tore the night apart, as did the newly exuberant anti-aircraft guns. According to Home Intelligence, people living near guns are suffering from serious lack of sleep. A number of interviews made round one gun in West London showed that people were getting much less sleep than others a few hundred yards away. But no one wanted the guns to stop. There is little complaint about lack of sleep, mainly because of the new exhilaration created by the barrage. Nevertheless, this serious loss of sleep needs watching. Those Londoners who fled to public shelters found them poorly equipped for slumber, because pre-war civil defence planners had not anticipated that air raids would occur at night. "It's not the bombs I'm scared of anymore. It's the weariness," wrote a female civil servant in her mass observation diary. "Trying to work and concentrate with your eyes sticking out of your head like hatpins after being up all night. I'd die in my sleep happily if only I could sleep." A survey found that 31% of respondents reported getting no sleep on the night of September 11th. Another 32% got less than 4 hours. Only 15% said they slept more than six. Conversation was devoted to one topic only: where and how to sleep, wrote Virginia Coles. The where part was particularly challenging. Everyone had theories on the subject. Some preferred the basement. Others said the top of the house was safer than being trapped under debris. Some recommended a narrow trench in the back garden, and still others insisted it was best to forget it and die comfortably in bed. A small percentage of Londoners used the underground for shelter, though popular myth would later convey the impression that all of London flocked to the system's deep subway stations. On the night of September 27th, when police counted the highest number of people sheltering in these tube stations, the total was 177,000, or about 5% of the population then remaining in London. And Churchill, at first, wanted it this way. Having a lot of people concentrated in stations conjured for him the nightmare of hundreds of lives, possibly thousands, lost to a single bomb, should one penetrate to the train platforms far below ground. And, indeed, on September 17th, a bomb would strike the Marble Arch tube stop, killing 20 people. In October, four direct hits on stations would kill or wound 600. It was the Prof, however, who persuaded Churchill that deep shelters that could house large numbers of people were necessary. "A very formidable discontent is now arising," the Prof told him. "People wanted a safe and quiet night." A November survey, however, found that 27% of London's residents used their own domestic shelters, mostly so-called Anderson shelters, named for John Anderson, Minister for Home Security. These were metal enclosures designed to be buried in yards and gardens, builders being able to protect occupants from all but a direct hit, though protecting them from flooding, mould and bone-chilling cold was proving a confounding challenge. Many more Londoners, by one estimate as many as 71%, just stayed in their homes, sometimes in their basements, often in their beds. Churchill slept at 10 Downing Street. When the bombers came, much to the consternation of Clementine, he climbed to the roof to watch. On Thursday, September 12th, a £4,000 bomb, apparently of the Satan variety, landed in front of St. Paul's Cathedral and penetrated the ground to a depth of 26 feet, but did not detonate. Men tunnelled to reach it and hauled it gingerly to the surface 3 days later. The tunnellers were among the first to win a new award for civilian bravery, created at the request of the King, the George Cross. The next day, bombs again struck Buckingham Palace, this time a near miss for the royal couple. They had driven in from Windsor Castle, through weather that suggested that raids would be unlikely, with rain falling from a thickly overcast sky. The couple were speaking with the King's private secretary, Alec Harding, in an upstairs room overlooking the large open quadrangle at the centre of the palace, when they heard the roar of an aircraft and saw two bombs fly past. Two explosions shook the palace. "We looked at each other, and then we were out into the passage as fast as we could get there," the King wrote in his diary. "The whole thing happened in a matter of seconds. We all wondered why we weren't dead." He was convinced the palace was the intended target. The aircraft was seen coming straight down the Mall below the clouds, having dived through the clouds, and had dropped two bombs in the forecourt, two in the quadrangle, one in the chapel and the other in the garden. A police constable guarding the palace told the Queen it had been a magnificent piece of bombing. Though the bombing itself quickly became public knowledge, the narrowness of the royal couple's escape was kept secret, even from Churchill, who learned of it only well afterward while writing his personal history of the war. The episode left the King shaken. "It was a ghastly experience, and I don't want it to be repeated," he confided in his diary. "It certainly teaches one to take cover on all future occasions, but one must be careful not to become dugout-minded." For a time, however, he remained uneasy. "I quite disliked sitting in my room on Monday and Tuesday," he wrote the following week. "I found myself unable to read, always in a hurry and glancing out of the window." The bombing had a positive side. The attack, the King observed, made him and his wife feel a closer connection to the masses. The Queen put it succinctly, "I'm glad we've been bombed. It makes me feel I can look the East End in the face." As the weekend neared, invasion fears became acute. With the moon almost full and favourable tides in the offing, Londoners began calling it Invasion Weekend. On Friday, September 13th, Home Forces Commander General Brooke wrote in his diary, "Everything looks like an invasion starting tomorrow from the Thames to Plymouth. I wonder whether we shall be hard at it by this time tomorrow." Sufficiently grave were these concerns that on Saturday, Churchill sent a directive to Pug Ismay, War Cabinet Secretary Edward Bridges, and other senior officials, asking them to visit a special fortified compound established in northwest London called the Paddock, where, if worst came to worst, the government could retreat and still function. The idea of the government evacuating Whitehall was anathema to Churchill, who feared the defeatist signal this would send to the public, to Hitler, and especially to America. But now he saw a new urgency. In his minute, he directed his ministers to examine the quarters designated for them and to be ready to move there at short notice. He insisted they avoid all publicity while making these preparations. "We must expect," he wrote, "that the Whitehall-Westminster area will be the subject of intensive air attack any time now. The German method is to make the disruption of the central government a vital prelude to any major assault upon the country. They have done this everywhere. They will certainly do it here, where the landscape can be so easily recognized and the river and its high buildings affords a sure guide both by day and night. Though invasion anxiety soared and rumours flew, scores of parents in London and elsewhere in England felt a new sense of peace that weekend. With great relief, these parents settled their children aboard a ship named the City of Benares in Liverpool to evacuate them to Canada, in the hope of keeping them safe from bombs and the impending German invasion. The ship carried 90 children, many accompanied by their mothers, the rest travelling alone. The passenger manifest included one boy, whose parents feared that since he had been circumcised at birth, he might be ruled a Jew by the invading forces. 4 days after the ship's departure, 600 miles out at sea, with a gale raging, the ship was torpedoed by a U-boat and sunk, killing 265 souls, including 70 of the 90 children on board. Chapter 47. Terms of Imprisonment. At Chequers, Mary Churchill settled herself into a bedroom on the third floor of the house, which could be reached by a secret spiral staircase from the Hawtrey room below. A more conventional path, via an ordinary hallway, also gave access to the room, but Mary preferred the stairs. The room was isolated on an otherwise unoccupied floor and tended to be cold and draughty, exposed to winds that wuthered, her term, around the outside walls. It had sloping ceilings and a large fireplace that did little to dispel the cold. She loved it. The room was imbued with mystery, and, like everything else at Chequers, it evoked the distant past. For centuries, it had been known as the prison room, its name deriving from an episode that occurred in 1565, an era when royal displeasure could yield deeply unpleasant outcomes. That prisoner, another Mary, Lady Mary Grey, younger sister of the far better known and far worse treated Lady Jane Grey, famously executed in 1554, decided to marry in secret a commoner named Thomas Keyes, who managed security for Queen Elizabeth I. The marriage offended the Queen for a variety of reasons, not least of which was the likelihood that it would bring ridicule to the royal household, owing to the fact the bride was tiny, perhaps a dwarf, and the groom enormous, said to be the largest man in the court. The Queen's secretary, Sir William Cecil, described the match as monstrous. The Queen threw Keyes into Fleet Prison and ordered the then owner of Chequers, William Hawtrey, to lock Lady Mary in the house and keep her there until further notice, except for occasional ventures outside for air. She was released 2 years later, her husband a year after that, but they never saw each other again. Two small windows provided a view of Beacon Hill. At night, even though Chequers was 40 miles from London, modern Mary saw the distant flare of anti-aircraft guns and heard their distinctive crump and rumble. Often aircraft passed over the house, prompting her at times to hide her head under the covers. The house, Mary saw, threatened to be very quiet on weekdays, though she was delighted that her parents had imported Nana White, her childhood nanny, from Chartwell for that first weekend. It helped, too, that her sister-in-law, Pamela Churchill, was now also ensconced in the house, waiting impatiently for little Winston, Mary observed in her diary. The house enlivened markedly that Friday, September 13th, with the arrival of Churchill, Clementine, and the private secretary on duty, John Martin, and with the happy prospect of Mary celebrating her 18th birthday on Sunday. The weekend would also present what Mary called gripping distractions. Churchill and Clementine stayed at Chequers through lunch on Saturday, but drove to London in the afternoon. Churchill planned to come back the next day for the party. Clementine returned that evening with a surprise. "Mummy had ordered a lovely cake for me despite raids," Mary wrote in her diary. "How sweet she is." That night, Mary mused upon her own advancing age in a lengthy entry in her diary, describing Saturday as "the last day that I shall be sweet 17. There was war, yes, but she could not help herself. She exulted in her life. "What a wonderful year it has been," she wrote. "I think it will always stand out in my memory. It has been very happy for me, too, despite the misery and unhappiness in the world. I hope that does not mean that I am unfeeling. I really don't think I am. But somehow I just haven't been able to help being happy." She acknowledged a heightened sensitivity to the world around her. "I think I have felt fear and anxiety and sorrow in small doses for the first time in my life. I do so love being young, and I don't very much want to be 18. Although I often behave in a completely idiotic and haywire fashion, yet I feel I have grown up quite a lot in the last year. I am glad of it." She went to bed as gunfire lit the sky over distant London. Churchill returned to Chequers on Sunday in time for lunch. Afterward, observing that the weather on this day seemed suitable to the enemy, he set out with Clementine, Pamela, and Secretary Martin to pay another visit to the Fighter Command Operations Centre at Uxbridge. Upon arrival, Churchill, Clementine, and the others were led down stairways 50 feet underground to the operations room, which looked to Churchill like a small theatre, 2 stories high and 60 feet across. The room was quiet at first. Earlier in the day, a major air battle had taken place after more than 200 bombers and their fighter escorts had crossed the coastline, but this had subsided. As Churchill and the others made their descent, the commander of No. 11 Group, Air Vice Marshal Keith Park, said, "I don't know whether anything will happen today. At present, all is quiet." The family took seats in what Churchill called the dress circle. Below was a vast map on a table, attended by 20 or so men and women and various assistants answering telephones. The opposite wall was taken up entirely by a light board, with banks of coloured bulbs that denoted the status of each squadron. Red lights indicated fighters in action. Another bank showed those returning to their airfields. Officers in a glass-enclosed control room, Churchill called it a stage box, evaluated information phoned in from radar operators and the Air Ministry's 30,000-strong network of human observers. The quiet did not last. Radar detected aircraft massing over Dieppe on the French coast and advancing toward England. Initial reports put the total of attacking planes at 40-plus. Lights began to glow in the board on the far wall, showing that RAF fighter squadrons were now standing by, meaning ready to take off on 2 minutes' notice. More reports came in of German aircraft approaching, and these were announced as blandly as if they were trains arriving at the station. 20-plus, 40-plus, 60-plus, 80-plus. The staff attending the map table began sliding discs across its surface toward England. These represented the approaching German forces. On the far wall, red lights blinked on as hundreds of Hurricanes and Spitfires took to the air from bases throughout southeast England. The German discs shifted steadily forward. On the light board, the bulbs that indicated aircraft held in reserve went dark, meaning every single fighter in No. 11 Group was now engaged. Messages from observers on the ground poured in via telephone, reporting sightings of German aircraft, their type, number, direction, and approximate altitude. During a typical raid, thousands of these messages would arrive. A single young officer directed the group's fighters toward the intruders, his voice, as Churchill recalled, a calm, low monotone. Vice Marshal Park was clearly anxious and walked back and forth behind the officer, now and then preempting him with orders of his own. As the battle progressed, Churchill asked, "What other reserves have we?" Park answered, "There are none." Long a student of war, Churchill knew well that this meant the situation was very grave. The RAF's fighters carried only enough fuel to keep them aloft for about an hour and a half, after which they had to land to refuel and reload their guns. On the ground, they would be dangerously vulnerable. Soon the light board showed the RAF squadrons returning to base. Churchill's anxiety rose. What losses should we not suffer if our refueling planes were caught on the ground by further raids of 40-plus or 50-plus, he wrote. But the German fighters, too, were reaching their operational limits. The bombers they accompanied could have stayed aloft far longer, but, like their RAF counterparts, the Luftwaffe fighters had only 90 minutes of endurance, which included the time they needed to make their way back across the English Channel to their coastal bases. The bombers could not risk flying without protection, and therefore had to return as well. These limitations, according to German ace Adolf Galland, became more and more of a disadvantage. During one raid, his own group lost a dozen fighters, 5 of which had to make what were known as pancake landings on French beaches, the other 7 forced to ditch in the channel itself. An ME-109 could float for up to a minute, which Gallant counted as just about long enough for the pilot to unstrap himself and to scramble out, at which point he would deploy his May West life preserver or a small rubber dinghy and fire a flare in hopes of being rescued by the Luftwaffe's air-sea rescue service. As Churchill watched, the light board indicated more and more RAF squadrons returning to their fields. But now, also, the staff at the map table began moving the discs representing German bombers back toward the Channel and the French coast. The battle was over. The Churchills climbed up to the surface just as the all clear sounded. Awed by the idea of so many young pilots dashing headlong into battle, Churchill, in the car, said aloud to himself, "There are times when it is equally good to live or to die." They returned to Chequers at 4:30 p.m., Churchill exhausted, only to learn that a planned Allied assault on the West African city of Dakar, to be commanded by General de Gaulle, using British and Free French troops, was threatened by the unexpected appearance of warships that had escaped British confiscation and were now under the control of the pro-German Vichy government. After a quick call to London at 5:15 p.m., during which he recommended that the operation, codenamed Menace, be cancelled, he went to bed for his afternoon nap. Ordinarily, his naps lasted an hour or so. This day, drained by the drama of the afternoon's air battle, he slept until 8 p.m. Upon waking, he summoned the duty secretary, Martin, who brought him the latest news from all quarters. "It was repellent," Churchill recalled. "This had gone wrong here, that had been delayed there, an unsatisfactory answer had been received from so-and-so, there had been bad sinkings in the Atlantic." Martin reserved the good news until the end. "However," he now told Churchill, "all is redeemed by the air. We have shot down 183 for a loss of under 40. These numbers were so extraordinary that throughout the Empire, September the 15th became known as Battle of Britain Day, although this count, too, proved to be incorrect, greatly inflated by the usual heat of battle exaggeration. There was more joy that Sunday night at Chequers when Mary's birthday celebration got underway. Her sister Sarah brought her a leather writing portfolio. A friend sent chocolates and silk stockings. Cousin Judy sent a congratulatory telegram. Mary was delighted by the attention. "How sweet everyone is in these terrible times to remember me being 18, she wrote that night in her diary. "I do appreciate it terribly." She closed the entry, "I went to bed 18, very happy." She was delighted, too, by the prospect of starting work the next day with the Women's Voluntary Service at Aylesbury.